not guilty. It's more like no contest, really. My name's Mark. I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is May 30th, 2001, and for that I'm truly grateful. So if Chris had told me there was like this many people here, I might have like come up with a cold or something like that. When I walked up here, I saw all these people and I was like, holy shit, there's a lot of people here. So needless to say, I'm extremely nervous. You know, I always, whenever I speak at a meeting or whenever I, you know, tell my story, I always want to say something that like blows everybody's mind. And the truth is, I'm just another bozo on the bus. You know, I got fortunate and I got this thing, you know, and I was able to get sober. And really what I'm here to do is tell, you know, what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. And that's my experience. So, you know, I did not grow up in a normal home. My dad wasn't around. My parents got a divorce at a very early age. It was me and my sister and my mom. I was adopted. So right away there was problems. You know, I had identity issues. I didn't know who I was. I wasn't with my biological family, and so things were, I was in a lot of trouble like very early on, even in kindergarten. You know, I mean, I was getting in fights and getting in a lot of trouble, and so long before I ever took my first drink, there was a lot of warning signs. You know, I mean. I remember my fifth grade year in elementary school. I spent the majority of that year like in the office or in detention or in suspension or something. And it was all for like, you know, just getting in trouble with the teacher, fighting, hanging out with the wrong crowd. And I took my first drink when I was 12. You know, I like to say I was born an alcoholic because I don't know what social drinking is, man. I mean, that's just weird to me. I've never socially drank. I never set out to have a couple of beers. It was always like just I set out to get fucked up. And the first time I got drunk, I don't remember what I drank. I hear people tell their story and they're like, oh, I drank this. And I have no idea what it was, some kind of funky wine. I know I threw up and felt great and I was going to do it again as soon as possible. You know, and I was in a lot of trouble in school, but I got good grades. I played sports, and as soon as I took my first drink, all of that changed. I did like a complete 180, and you know, Chris talks about we kind of came from the same crowd. I had an older sister who was she was in the punk rock scene, and so I started hanging out with her. I got a mohawk, started going to punk rock shows. My sister used to date this guy, and his name was Martian. And he had this big, bright red mohawk, and he was in this band called Criminal Crew. And he used to get up on stage and scream, and you couldn't understand a word he said. But this guy, I thought, was the coolest individual on the planet, and I hung out with him as much as possible. So needless to say, I got in a lot of trouble, and my mother was extremely concerned because my behavior changed so quickly. As soon as I started drinking, that I ended up in my first rehab when I was 13 years old. you know, I went through, back then it was like a 60-day program. Now a lot of the programs are 30 days, but I stayed in this program for 60 days. I got out and I went to my first AA meeting at 13. And I went to this club in Austin called the Northland Club. And I showed up there. I had a skateboard. My hair was spiked up all over the place. I was wearing a Minor Threat t-shirt, and I pull it. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Northland, but it's primarily like guys with cowboy hats, and they all had coffee cups, but they were all spitting dip in it. None of them were drinking coffee. And there was like tons of trucks out front, and I pull in there, and I'm carrying my skateboard, and I was late. The meeting had already started, and I walk in the door, and the whole meeting stopped, and everybody turned around and looked at me and was like, what the hell? You know, like nobody had ever seen a kid like, you know, my age for one, and you know, my hair spiked up all over the place. But, you know, I sat down, went to the meeting, and afterwards I got pretty much accosted by these guys after the meeting. They're all like, hey, you know, they're giving me their phone numbers and shaking my hand. Everybody was really friendly, and they were all like, one of the guys in there, he was like the biggest, baddest redneck in the building, you know, and he comes up and he's like, we're going to this meeting tomorrow night and you're coming with us, and then we're going here on the next night, and then we go to Cocos and we have coffee. And I was like, okay, man, whatever, dude, I'll do whatever, you know? And so I went to meetings with these guys and we would go out to dinner afterwards and we would hang out, and these guys would tell these stories of like how they had lost cars and houses and wives and bar fights and went to prison and all of this stuff. And I was like, wow, these guys are so cool. You know, I would listen to these stories like, oh my God, these guys are awesome. And they had some of the best stories. And turns out I did a lot of those things and not so cool, but sounded good at the time. But so anyway, that was my introduction into AA, you know, and I stayed sober at that point, I think for 11 months and 20 days. I was like 10 days away from a year, and I relapsed and went back out. And that was the first of many times, many trips in and out of AA. I spent the majority of my adolescence going in and out of rehabs, and I would get... I would put some time together and I would go to meetings and I was just in a lot of trouble, and my mother didn't know what to do with me, so she kept throwing me in treatment centers, and I wanted to live on the street. Like I wanted to be like a gutter punk, and I had, you know, all my heroes were like people who had died from like vomiting on, you know, choking on their own vomit. I mean, I thought these were like the coolest people, people who had OD'd, and I wanted nothing really to do with getting sober at that age. But, you know, I was in and out of treatment. I would put together 6 months here, 9 months here, and a lot of it was just to, you know, sort of stay out of trouble. I've been in some of the nicest treatment centers in the country. I've been in Hazelden in Minnesota. It was like this cabin in the woods. It's like a really beautiful place, and there's snow, and I've been in places like that, and I've also been in the Austin State Hospital a few times. So I've been in the best and the worst, you know, and the bottom line is at that age, I didn't want it, you know, I didn't want this thing. So I think after my second trip in Hazelden, and by the way, from the time I was 13 to the time I was 18, I think I had like 13 trips in and out of rehab. So there's a lot of different rehabs. I think, I was 15, 16 and I had just gotten out of rehab again. And I relapsed again, and I was seeing this counselor, and my mother was ready to throw me back in a treatment center again, and the counselor said, you know what, he's been to enough treatment centers, just throw him out of the house. And she's like, all right, as soon as we get back, you're out of the house. I was like, yes, finally. I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be left alone, and I wanted to drink. And so I got the opportunity. I was 16, and I had just turned 17. I remember this now. It's all coming back. I was 16 and I just turned 17. And so I was sort of let off on my own. I was doing my own thing. And 2 weeks after I turned 17, I got arrested for the first time. And for those of you who are from Texas, when you're 17, you're an adult. I thought I was going to juvie. I was really disappointed that I had to go to adult jail for the first time. And that was the first of many trips in and out of jail. I remember when I got out, I tried to stay sober for a little bit, and I went to this same counselor, and I remember him telling me, he said, you know, if you continue down this path, he's like, you're not a criminal, but you're going to be treated like one. And I'm like, man, I'll never go back to jail. And he's like, no, it's not the way it's going to go down. You will go back to jail. And he was right. So like I said, that was the first of many trips in and out of jail. By the time I turned 18, you know, that was my first adult charge. By the time I turned 18, I was facing a whole bunch of charges, and I was left a inheritance from a relative, so I had some money, and I was able to always hire lawyers and get myself out of jail, and I was facing some pretty serious time, but I had a good lawyer, you know, there was a night I was supposed to be in court the next day. I stayed up all night doing coke and didn't show up. And so what do? I check myself into rehab. I got the warrant lifted. And I went in there and said, oh, I want to get sober, this and that. And so they put me on probation, you know, and I was able to throw some money around and get out of trouble. And that was kind of how my younger years went. but they put me on some intensive supervision probation. And I had to go and take piss tests every week, and the my probation officer calls me one day, and says, listen, man, he's like, you failed your last 8 piss tests. And I was like, well, you know, I don't know what you want me to do. I mean, I can't stop. And so they court ordered me to go to another rehab. So I went to this rehab for two days and checked out. And that was the last time I went to rehab. I was 18, 19. And when I left that place, I swore that I would never get sober. I swore that I would never come back to AA. I thought that, you know, AA was a bunch of cigarette smoking, coffee drinking hypocrites, and I swore I was never going back. I figured I'd rather die. And so I went off on a long journey, and I was seeing a girl at the time, and she had moved back to Florida. And so I moved out to Florida. I figured if I went out there, I could, like, stay out of trouble. But apparently there's a lot of trouble out in Florida, too. So I go out to Florida. I sort of stayed at bay for a little while because I had all these warrants out for my arrest. And you know, I finally got a job for the first time in my life. I was like, I don't know, 20 or something like that. I got a job and got married, had a kid. And sort of like I kind of thought I was like living the American dream. You know, I would go to work, get dirty, come home, and drink myself to sleep every night. And I thought that was it, man. This is what life is about. This is great. And, you know, I had to go and turn myself in eventually for the warrants I had here. I was able to get out, get on probation, and I went back to Florida. And, you know, I spent a long time. I had like 6 years of probation at that point in time. And so I spent some time like at home. I stopped going out. I stopped getting in fights. And I figured the less people I hung around with, the less trouble I was going to get into. But I drank myself to sleep pretty much every night. Ate tons of pills, smoked tons of pot, and went to work. And I thought that was it, man. This was life. And so about the time I was getting close to getting off probation, I was getting real restless. You know, I had held myself at bay as long as I could. And as soon as I got off probation, I got in this huge fight with my wife at the time. She threw me out of the house. I was like, yes. And I went off on a 2 or 3 year run. You know, I told you I had this inheritance, and I had quite a bit of money at the time. You know, I mean, I was given quite a bit of money. I probably would have never had to really work a day in my life had I have invested it properly, or whatever. But I was out of money. I had spent it all. It was all gone, partying and buying stuff, and my house. I'd gotten back together with my wife. My house was refinanced. I had 3 cars. They were all financed. I had a truck that I was parking in the backyard because the repo man was coming by every night looking for it. And I had like this double fence, and so I would just pull the truck around the backyard where he couldn't get to it. And I had nothing left. I mean, there was nothing. So I met this guy, and I had about at the time a $300 a day habit. I was doing heroin, and I had about a $300 a day habit. I met this guy, and he had tons of money and didn't work. And I was like, what do you do? And he says, well, I forge checks. And I was like, really? Well, how does that work? And he told me, and I said, can you teach me how to do it? And he was like, absolutely. And so I went out and forged checks for about 2 months. And I got up every day, and I would get dressed in the best clothes I had, get cleaned up, and go out and forge checks. That's what I did for 2 months. And it's funny, you know, that there's cameras in the bank. They have my picture. I'm already a convicted felon. They got my fingerprints on the checks, on the desks, and everything. They caught up to me. Imagine that. And so this time I got locked up, and this was December 29th, 1999. When I got locked up, I had, at that point in time, I had about a $300 a day habit still. I was on 120 milligrams of methadone a day, and I was pretty much drinking around the clock, you know, as much as I could. I mean, that's where my disease had progressed. You know, I started shooting coke at 15, and it just progressed into everything else. I was a garbage head. You know, I'd put anything in my body. I did whatever, whenever. If it was there, it sounded good. It, you know, people talked about ketamine doing cat tranquilizers. I'm like, has anybody got an elephant tranquilizer? I'd rather do that. You know, I mean, that was my attitude. You know, and so I did pretty much whatever was in front of me. You know, But at that time, you know, I mean, I full-blown heroin addict, 120 milligrams of methadone. And when I got locked up, I was on the news, on the local news, because what I had been doing was a very large-scale amount of money. And I knew I wasn't going anywhere. At this point, I had $75,000 bond, and I knew I was going to be sick. I knew it was going to be bad. And I made one last effort. I called my mom and I said, "Mom, I'm locked up." She's like, "Good, great. No one have to worry about you." I was like, "Okay, I guess that's not going to happen." So, anyway, when they locked me up, they put me in this little tiny holding cells, one person holding cell. And I remember they wheeled this phone to me, and I'm sitting there like this, and it's freezing. And I was thinking to myself, like, well, finally this nightmare is over. But I still wasn't done, you know. I still wasn't done. Anyway, I end up getting 18 months in prison. And that was the first time, you know, there was no way out of this. I had a public defender. I had no money left, no nothing. There was no way. I was lucky all I got was 18 months. you know, people talk about staying sober in prison. I mean, it's you know, I didn't stay sober in prison. I mean, it's much easier to go get high in prison than it is. I don't have to get in a car. I just walk down the cell block, you know. But, you know, we were burning off batches of wine and everything. You know, I mean, I had no interest at this point in time getting sober. And I remember, and I always tell this when I tell my story, because this is where my life had become. This is what my life had become. I was sitting there playing cards, which is what you do when you're in prison. Playing spades. Yes, I was playing spades. And there was a kid that he had gotten locked up, and he had like a minimum mandatory. And he had gotten 10 years for some weed. I mean, he got a really bad rap. But anyway, we're sitting there talking, and he says to me, he says, "You think you'll ever come back here to prison?" And I looked him in the eye, and I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why would you say that? What are you talking about, man?" And I said, "Well, this is what happens. This is part of life, man. You know, this is what happens. When you do what we do, this is what happens. You come to prison. You lose everything. People leave, you know. You get divorced. All of that." And that's what my life had become. And I was okay with that. That was fine with me. I had accepted that, you know, going to prison for me and going to jail was like a rite of passage where I came from. Some people, you know, graduate college. I mean, that was, everybody I know had already been, and they're all like, "Ah, finally, yeah, you're one of the club." You know? So getting close to the time of me getting out, I had, I don't know, a couple weeks, a couple months left, and I was talking to my dad on the phone. I was talking to my mom on the phone, and she says, "You know, what are you going to do when you get out?" And I said, "I don't know. You know, maybe I'll go live with my dad. Go back to Texas and live with my dad." And she said, "Well, listen, I got an idea. It's just a suggestion. We'll give you a couple bucks. We'll get you in a treatment center, in a halfway house, whatever it is you think you need, and give you one last opportunity to change your life. But this is it, man." They were clear. My stepdad, my mom, they were like, "This is fucking it. You either take this opportunity, or that's it. If you don't, we're not picking up the pieces ever again." And I remember getting off the phone with her, and I had to go back to my cell and think about that. You know, do I really want to get sober? Do I really want to do this? You know, there's a part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous where it talks about going on to the bitter end. And my question was, well, how bitter is the end? How bad can it be? You know, and so against my better judgment, I went to a halfway house in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. And it was, you know, I went there because I really had nothing else to do. I had nowhere else to go. And so my plan was to go there, get sober for a little while, maybe meet some like cougar on Palm Beach Island who would like give me a credit card and take care of me. That never happened. you know, and I thought like maybe this will happen, and you know, just get everybody off my back, get off probation, and then go back out and drink. And that was my plan. So I went to this halfway house, and I went there, I got out, and I went and met up with some friends of mine and had one last good drunk. You know, that was it. It was my final hoorah before I had to go stay sober for a little while. And so I went to this halfway house and sort of carried myself in there, hungover. And that was May 30th, 2001. And I went in there and I was, you know, all these people are bitching about this guy stole their food and this and that. I was just happy to be free, man. Like I could walk outside and do what I wanted to, you know. And And I stayed away from everybody. But the group of guys that I lived with in my part of the halfway house were going to meetings every day. And so I went to meetings with them because I didn't want to get in trouble. I wanted to look good. I wanted people to leave me alone. And so I went to meetings with these guys every day. And that went on for, I don't know, 2 months. And there was plenty of opportunities there, man. Guys were relapsing all the time and getting thrown out, and there was plenty of opportunities. But I stayed sober, and I went to meetings, and I sort of sat in the back. I was pretty pissed off. I was a pretty angry dude. Some people still think I'm angry, but I'm not nearly as angry as I was then. But I sat in the back with my arms crossed, and I was, you know, scowl on my face, and I had all these earrings hanging out of my face, and I looked pretty mean, and nobody came up to me. They in Florida, they have these things called white chips. They're like what the equivalent of a desire chip, and I never picked one up. You know, I just sort of sat in the back, and the longer I stayed sober, the more and more miserable I got, and the worse things got. And I remember, 2 months in, I was sitting in a meeting, and this guy was speaking, and he was up at a podium, and he was real colorful. He was one of those guys. He was funny, and he could keep you interested, and he had a lot of knowledge, and he was waving his arms, and for some reason I was paying attention to this guy, and he said something to the effect of, you know, every human being, and alcoholics included, have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that the only way an alcoholic was going to get those things was by getting sober and working the steps. And I don't know why, but that was the first thing I had heard, and that was the only thing I needed to hear. And I walked out of that meeting, and I realized I was freaking miserable, right? And I had a sponsor who I had not called. He was my sponsor for like 2 months. I had never called him. I called him up, and I said, man, I don't know what's going on here, but you know, I've been sober for like 2 months, and you know, I've got a choice to either do this work or go back out and drink, or maybe I should just go rob a store and go back to prison because I seem to be fine there. But this whole life thing isn't working for me, man. I don't know what's going on. And so he came and picked me up, and we went to another meeting, and afterwards we sat down and talked, and he explained to me that the second part of the first step is it talks about unmanageability. And he explained to me that unmanageability was the fact that when you take a drink away from me and you take the drugs away from me, all of a sudden I don't know what the hell's going on anymore. Life is completely out of control. And I was more miserable without than I you know, being sober than I was. And everybody around me is like laughing, having a good time. Everybody's happy, and I couldn't figure out why. And he explained to me that was the unmanageability of this disease. If you take a drink or drug away from me, without spiritual help, I'm done. I'll go back out and drink. And he asked me if I believed in a power greater than myself. And I said, you know, I don't know. I said, I don't know. If there's some sort of God out there, I don't know. Spirit of the universe, whatever, I have no idea. But if there is, why in the fuck is it going to help me? And he said, what the hell do you have to lose? You know? And he also explained a lot of things about how I was feeling in that moment was the way I felt all the time. And he was right. And that's why I continued to drink. I always found, you know, I hear a lot of people talk in meetings, you know, that alcohol stopped working for them. You know, maybe they didn't do pills. I don't know. Because you take enough of them and you pass out and it's working. You know, as long as I was in oblivion, things worked. And that was my life because I couldn't handle the way I felt all the time. It was, you know, and so I gave this thing a shot, man. I like to tell people, you know, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that there was no doubt in my mind. I knew that from the time I was 13, from the first time I went to an AA meeting. But I did my third step before I did the second step. I didn't believe that any power greater than myself was going to restore me to any kind of sanity. I had no idea. I just gave up and stopped fighting. And then it happened. I saw some sanity start to return, you know. And I had one of these terrible sponsors that like joined my home group to make sure that I volunteered to do shit. So you know, he makes me, the first thing he makes me do is, you know, they need a greeter for the meeting. I was a member of this group called the North Palm Beach Friendship Group. And and that we always had a greeter out at the front door. And he's like, "Oh, Mark will greet." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, shit, great." You know? And so I sat outside of this meeting reluctantly, and I was like, "Hey, welcome to the North Palm Beach Friendship Group." I was not real big fan of touching people and shaking people. I mean, I just, that was me, and you know, but it helped me become a part of, and that was a big thing for me, is feeling a part of AA and a part of the program. And he was big on service, man. He was real big on service, and so he pushed me into doing all kinds of service positions, and it saved my life, man. I mean, I've been involved in many areas of Alcoholics Anonymous service. I've been involved in intergroup. I've helped coordinate like the volunteer phone slots for like people that call in at 3 a.m. and need help, and it was extremely rewarding. And then we worked the steps, and you know, step three for me was nothing more than a matter of stopping to, you know, stopping fighting and doing a four step. You know, and me and my sponsor had long talks about God and higher power and all this, and he's just like, "Look, man, we just need to dumb this down, and you need to do a four step. You want to know what a higher power is? Do a four step. You know, turning your will and your life over, do the four step." And so I balked at the four step. It was a very pivotal point of my sobriety, but I balked at it. It took me a long time to do it, but when I did it, I was completely ready to let all this stuff off. You know, there's a part in the book where it talks about going home and making sure we didn't forget anything, and sitting alone with ourselves for an hour. And I didn't forget anything, man. I was able to lay it all out there. I didn't have to call him back and say, "Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you this." And I sort of cheated too. I told him like the worst things about my four step, like before we even did it. And he's like, "Well, that's not that bad." And I was like, "Okay, cool, we can do this." But that was a huge point for me, and you know, making amends and you know, getting to. I was fortunate. I didn't do my four step too early and my eight step too early, because I had been in and out of the program so long that none of my family was really interested in hearing anything I had to say until I had been sober for a little over a year. So I finally made amends to them, and I have a great relationship with my family today. I mean, they actually, the first time I came to visit from Florida, they actually gave me the keys to their car, which was, you know, they wouldn't give me the keys to a mailbox, you know, before, but or a bike lock for that matter, you know. But I have a really good relationship with my family, and I owe that to being sober. You know, I continued to work the steps. I continued to stay involved, and my life is unbelievable, man. I've had some really awful things happen to me in sobriety, and not happen to me, but just things that happen to people. You know what I mean? And not like awful in that it's just tragic, but I've lost a business, I've lost a house, I've multiple relationships. I've been, you know, it's not estranged, but I've been apart from my daughter for long periods of time. She lives in Florida. I don't get to see her that often. You know, I mean, I do see her, but you know, things like that have happened. But when my business, when I lost that, I think I had like 8 years sober, and things just sort of like collapsed, man. The economy, because there was nothing I could have done, you know. The economy collapsed, everything collapsed, and everything was real bad, and I lost everything. I mean, I had built up all this stuff and lost it all. But the thing was, is I had done the work in this program, and I never even thought about drinking, never. And the people in AA came and picked me up, and they said, "Man, look, come on, we're going out to eat, we're going to a meeting, we're going to go to a movie, we're going to do this." And I hung out with those people, and they kept me up when I was down. And I've done that with multiple friends. You know, I've had friends die that have tried to get sober, and it's hard, man. You stay around long enough, you'll start stepping over the bodies, man. You see people that you love and care about that just can't get it, you know, and it's really hard. One of the things, you know, people say, you hear people in AA, they'll say, "Oh, I've never been to jail sober." Well, I have. It's not fun. It still sucks. It, you know, it's no better sober than it was drinking. But I had 4.5 years sober, and I was walking out of my house, and there was a cop waiting for me, and he said, "Are you Mark Seeley?" I said, "Yeah." And he's like, "You know, you got a warrant out for your arrest?" I was like, "Really?" And I had an old warrant out for my arrest from some of the forgery stuff I had done that never got picked up. And funny thing about, like, computers, man, they don't forget. Those warrants just don't go away, you know. And so I had to go to jail, and that was something else, man. But my mom, she helped bail me out. I got out. I went and I went to court, and I paid the money off, and it was time. You know, I had to make those amends, you know, and I didn't even know they were there, you know, but I had to make those amends, and I was able to do it, and I was able to go in front of the judge, and the judge could tell that there was a change in me, you know. She was like, "Wow, you know, you seem like you've really changed." And so they let me pay it off, and that was it. But all of that stuff that I've been through in sobriety has all made me who I am today. All the trials and the tribulations, all of that stuff has made me who I am today. It's made me stronger. And I wouldn't trade any of that for anything. I used to hear people in AA say stuff like, you know, their best day, their worst day sober is better than their best day drinking. I had some pretty good days drinking. But I can identify with that today because I truly love this way of life. You know, I tell people at some point I hit a bottom, and there's a trap door to every single bottom, you know, and there's no trap doors after you're dead. That's when the trap door's in, right? But, you know, you can always get lower. You can always go lower. But I hit a bottom that was sufficient enough for me. And there was a point in time in this program when I first got sober in AA that I realized I was free, man. Like, I didn't have to be a slave to heroin anymore. I didn't have to wake up and go out and get high every day because that shit's exhausting. And I couldn't stop. There was no possible way to stop. You know, when I violated my probation, and the probation officer said to me, "Oh, you failed these 8 piss tests," I was like, "What do you want from me? I don't know what to do. I can't stop." And he understood that, you know. But that's where I was. I couldn't stop. And I got a freedom from staying sober and for being in this program, for being in AA, that is, I'm just not willing to give up. You know, today I people ask me, like, what I do to stay sober today, and I don't even know. You know, I go to meetings, I help others, I do that sort of stuff, but all of it just sort of comes natural to me anymore. And I don't even really think about drinking. None of that stuff, it's just, like, not an option. I wake up every day wanting this more than I want to drink or get high. Every day. Because I just can't imagine going back to that way of life. You know, I've got a daughter who is, she's turning 13 now, which is really fun. But and she lives in Florida, but we still have a very good relationship. And she's never seen me drink. You know, she's seen me act like a jackass a few times, but she's never seen me drink. You know, and that's real important. Now, I've got a son who I have somewhat of a rocky relationship with, and he has seen me drink. He saw me at my worst. We have a better relationship because I'm sober, but, it's still somewhat rocky. But my daughter has not ever seen me drink, and that is something that is really important to me. And she also, you know, she's 13, but she also has this healthy fear of drinking at her age, and her mother and I have both had talks with her. And she has a healthy fear of that she could possibly be an alcoholic as well. And so she stays away from it. And she tells us about parties where there's alcohol. I mean, it's amazing to me, you know. But, you know, the gifts in this that I've gotten in AA are just unbelievable. I've got friends today. I've got friends that I've had for 16 years, you know, which that are all sober. I've got two friends of mine. When I was locked up, I wrote a friend of mine who was also locked up here in Texas, and another friend of mine who was locked up here in Texas wrote me back, and then he wrote me back, and we were all three writing each other. We were all locked up, and we're all sober now, you know. And those guys were like, I mean, we were road dogs. I mean, we were always together, and I talk to those guys all the time. I mean, it's some of the relationships that I've I've gained in this program are just unbelievable. They're true relationships, true friendships, and you know, one of the gifts too of AA is you know, you stay sober long enough, and even if you haven't been sober that long, I mean, my sponsor was like he was big on service, you know. When I got a car, he's like, "You're gonna go pick this guy up for the meeting." I didn't have much time, and he's like, "You're gonna." And that's service, you know. I took guys to meetings, and I did what I, you know, and I've been able to take a couple guys through the steps, you know, more than a couple guys, but I've been able to take a few guys through the steps. And let me tell you, man, there's nothing like when you get to take somebody through this work, and you see the light go off in their eyes, and you know that they've got it, you know, that they've actually got this, what this is, you know, and you know that they're going to move forward. There's nothing like it. And to know that you had a small part to do with that is just unbelievable. It's unbelievable. You know, and I've also had to go deeper into some other work. I've been involved in another program called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I've had to, after multiple years of sobriety, I've had to go and look at my family of origin stuff and look at some of the reasons why I drank in the first place, you know, some of the stuff that had happened to me in my childhood that was bad, you know, and I had to go back and look at it. And some of that stuff was real painful to look at, but I was able to do it because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the work that I had done in there. And I kept doing the steps over and over. I kept doing the work over and over, and I never gave up, you know, and I found another program that did, you know, there's stuff I had to do. And so today, you know, what do I do to stay sober? I just keep moving forward. You know, I try not to hide anything. I try, you know, I try to tell people what's going on and talk to my sponsor and all of that, you know, and I go to meetings and try to help other people when they ask for it. And sometimes when they don't, I'll help them anyway, you know, and I just try to be available, you know. The drinking thing is not an issue anymore. I don't think about it. This whole life thing is, you know, I work on that every day. You know, a lot of, you know, I still have fear, still get resentments. I still have to work on all of that stuff. You know, I heard somebody in a meeting one time talk about, you know, if they made a pill that would make me normal. You know, if they made this pill, and I remember this guy talking about it, and I raised my hand in the meeting, and I said, "Man, if somebody ever makes that pill, I don't fucking want it. I'd probably blow my brains out. I would not know how to live my life if I wasn't constantly working on myself and constantly trying to be a better person than I am today. You know, constantly trying to just do better at this thing. And that's what life is about, and I love it. I love the journey, you know, it's been incredible, you know, and it's not always easy. And sometimes, you know, you need people to help you, and sometimes you're the one helping others, but, you know, we're all there for each other, you know. And you know, I can promise you, if you're new or you're coming back, I can promise you that if you stay sober and if you do the steps, your life will change. I guarantee it. And I didn't believe it. I heard all these guys, and I was like, "That's all horse shit. I don't believe it." But it happened. And that was against my own, you know, I didn't want any of this. I didn't want to be a nice guy. I didn't want any of that. And I got it because I did the work. It was all just like a byproduct that I had no idea was coming my way. And man, I wouldn't trade this life for anything. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous, all of it, you know, and it's given me a life. Like, you know, I used to hear people say this, and I was like, "Ah, it's bullshit." But it's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. No matter what happens today, I've got the people in these rooms, I've got my higher power, and I can get through it, you know. Yeah, it's unbelievable, man. And I hope I said something that that somebody could grab onto. I hope I said something, you know, that you can identify with, because, man, I really want to see. Like I said, there's nothing better when that light goes off, when somebody gets it and they're like, "Wow, this is it, man!" Because this life is so incredible, and yeah, I wouldn't trade it for anything. So I hope that I said something that somebody can identify with. I hope that you guys go out, man, and just give this thing your best shot, man, because you won't regret it, man. And yeah, that's all I got, man.